When I was growing up, mom and dad had this guy named Simran from India come and live at our house for like a year. He was studying to be a pilot. Simran was around my age, but he was a Sikh, and I don't know if you know this about Sikhs, but they never cut their hair, so he had really long beard and really long hair, and he wore a turban, and Simran and we loved each other and fought like brothers. To this day, he still comes to Arkansas at least once a year and hangs out with us. I think on my second or third Sunday as your preacher, Simran was in the audience sitting with my family. There was this guy with a turban and a beard, and y'all didn't know what to think about me, and I think some of y'all were like, this may be worse than we thought. But anyway, Simran, at one point when we were in high school, I was talking to him about, you know, Jesus and faith and the end of the world. And he said he doesn't believe what the Christians believe about the end of the world. He believes something else. Specifically, he believed in this guy named Nostradamus, who had made all these predictions, and some of them had come true. And Nostradamus and the Mayans had predicted that the world would end. Do you remember what year it was they predicted the world would end? 2012, that's right. And I remember listening to Simran talk about all the predictions that they had gotten right and how the world was going to end on 2012 and, like, being really scared about that. Like, that was a terrifying thing, the idea that the world was going to end in 2012. But I no longer believe in the Mayans' predictions. You know why? Because if the Mayans could predict the future, come on, there would still be Mayans, right? Like, they should have seen that coming, too. So we're in a series right now where we're talking about heaven and hell and what comes next and what Christians have believed comes next for historically throughout the years. And this matters so much because we live in a time that's uncertain, like no other time in my life and probably your life. A lot of us are thinking about what comes next and the end of the world. But we're also talking about this because this is building up to us talking about our vision and who we want to be for the next 10 years as a church. One of my favorite preachers is John Ortberg, and when he was in school studying to be a preacher, he was in this seminary class where this professor asked the class, okay, who wants to go to heaven? And of course, everybody raised their hand. And then the professor asked, who wants to go to heaven today? Like right now? And everybody's hand kind of went down because nobody seemed to want that immediately. Maybe one or two people raised their hand because they thought that was what you're supposed to do in a seminary class. But then the professor said, who wants to live in a world without poverty? Who wants to live in a world where kids don't go to bed hungry at night? Who wants to live in a world without divorce or cancer or racism or war? And everybody raised their hand. And the professor said, what you really want is heaven. Did you notice that the sermon title is called Homecoming, not Going Home? Because throughout the Bible, you will not find the phrase go to heaven mentioned one time. There are certain passages where people say they desire to depart and be with the Lord, like in Philippians. But when it comes to what the Bible means when it talks about heaven, we are the ones who are said to be waiting on its arrival. Like we talked about a couple of weeks ago, in the end of the Bible, heaven comes down like a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. That's in Revelation 21, which raises the question the great theologian Belinda Carlisle raised. What if heaven is a place on earth? That is funnier than you gave it credit for, church. One of the problems we have in the West, especially in America, is that we have split up the way we read the Bible is we have split up heaven and earth. We have split up the physical and the spiritual, but that is something the Bible never really does. In fact, it was known as one of the first heresies. Now, because I'm so good at reading people, I know what you woke up this morning burning on your mind, a question that was burning in your mind. I can just tell it. I can read the room. The question every one of us came here to wondering about was, what is Gnosticism? And you are in luck, because that's going to be what we talk about for the next few minutes. Gnosticism was the first Christian heresy. It was the thing that Christians fought against in the first century. And if we want to be like the first Christians, it's good to know what they fought against. So here's Gnosticism. It was this bad idea that what a human is a divine soul trapped in a material world. And in order to get free, to escape the material world, you needed to get some special knowledge from the elite people who could get you into the elite circle Bible, and after you were enlightened, if you were lucky enough to be, once you died, you would escape this world and turn into a spiritual being that was rid of flesh. Because flesh, for the Gnostics, was a bad word. Because we're a product of a bad creation. Now, here's where, if you read the Bible, you start to be like, well, isn't flesh a bad word in the Bible? Because Paul will write, you know, like, talk about flesh as a bad thing. But Paul's a Jew. And he knows the Bible, God in Genesis 1 created this world, created you, your bodies, and said that it was good. When Paul writes flesh, he writes the word sarx. Let me hear you say sarx. Sarx would be better translated sinful nature than flesh, because Paul knows that in the creation story, God creates the world and thinks it's good. But he also knows Genesis 3, where human beings disobeyed God and have this sinful nature now. So the Gnostics, the people that the early Christians were fighting against, like all of 1 John is basically written to talk about the badness of the Gnostic view. The Gnostics saw flesh as such a bad thing, they started to tell people that Jesus didn't even come in the flesh. He wasn't really a human being with skin and bones like you did. He didn't die in the flesh, and he certainly wasn't raised in the flesh, because flesh was bad, so God obviously wouldn't have come in a bodily form. The Gnostic idea of heaven is that we would become spiritual beings where we leave this world behind and live as spirits. Does that sound familiar? Because I think for a lot of people, that very thin view of heaven has kind of been what we've thought of. Heaven doesn't sound very interesting. The Christian story tells a different story. It tells a story where God creates a world that he says is good. He likes what he made. And we tend to forget the Bible did not start with Genesis 3 and evil and sin entering the world. The Bible starts in Genesis 1. God's original intent was to live in intimate fellowship with human beings on a good, curse-free earth. So did the sin entering the world, did evil entering the world cause God to abandon his original purposes? No. Throughout the Bible, the promise of God's future is a new earth, not a non-earth. It is significant that the Bible starts and ends with God and people together in a garden without evil, because the Bible is promising the ultimate restoration movement. So when the prophets, when they talk about heaven, they never talk about it as some, like, you know, clouds and harps and, you know, abstract stuff that's not very interesting. No, they talk about it like feasts and weddings and mountains dripping with wine. They talk about it as a new earth, a new heaven, renewed and restored. And so some of you might be thinking, well, that's in the Old Testament. But when Jesus is here, he talks about the age to come the way the prophets did. In fact, there's a time in the Gospel of Matthew where Jesus is talking about money and divorce and those kind of things. And in Matthew chapter 19, he just says this in passing. He says, "Truly I tell you, at the renewal of all things," which is a phrase that is referencing all the prophets and the way they thought about the future. When Jesus says at the renewal of all things, he uses a word, a Greek word called palingenesia. Let me hear you say palingenesia. What, genesia, that last part, what book of the Bible does that sound like? Genesis. Pala means again. Genesis again. Because God has never given up on his original creation. In fact, we have overlooked the very vocabulary the Bible gave us to talk about the future. Think about the words for the plans of God: redeem, resurrect, restore, renew, recover, regenerate. Every one of those means to return to a previous state, because God is the ultimate salvage artist. He loves to restore things to their original condition and even better. Okay, so on Sunday nights, somehow by the grace of God, I have started meeting with a group of people who don't go to church, don't believe in God, Jesus, Bible, all that stuff. And we're just going through the Bible together, a group of about 15 of these people. And I love it. It's the highlight of my week. And last week, one of these people who have, like, you know, a very checkered past, they don't have no reason to live a Christian life, and so they're not. But they love having meaningful conversations. And so last week when we were talking, this one guy said to me after the Bible study was over, he said, "I think God is evil." It's like, well, okay, that's not something most church people say. So, well, tell me about that. And he said, think about the way the world is. I mean, his parents got divorced. He'd been injured in war. All these different things. I think if God is going to allow the world to be like it is, and God is all-powerful, God must be evil. And in one of those Holy Spirit moments, I found myself saying this and thinking, we need to know this too. That Christian theology has for 2,000 years been saying, look, I don't understand why God allows the world to be the way it is. But the Christian hope is that somehow the transformed, redeemed world will be better than even Eden. When God finishes, when the smoke clears, we will somehow, the new Adam and Eve, the transformed Adam and Eve, the transformed you, will somehow be better than the original Adam and Eve. And this matters so much because for the last couple of hundred years, specifically in America, the way we talk about the Christian hope has been really, really bad. Christians in America specifically have bought into something called the rapture, which interestingly enough is not a word found in the Bible. Now, one of the strengths of our fellowship is we didn't go all in with the rapture. But do you know where that came from? It came from 200 years ago. There was a British evangelist named John Darby. John Darby had this idea that Jesus was going to come twice. His first coming would be in secret, and he would come and take away all Christians, rapturing them up to heaven. Now, how many of y'all have heard of the rapture? Okay, just want to make sure none of us got left behind. Now, John Darby made several trips to America, and that idea of the rapture started to catch on, and I mean really catch on. Did you know that there is a group of atheists, people who have signed off that they will always be atheists, they will die as atheists, and they do that so they can have this business, that if you pay $150, if the rapture happens, then they will come and rescue your pet. $150. For $15 a year, there's a group of Christians, there's five Christians who they check in every week onto a database, and if 1 week passes and three of the five don't check into the database, they assume the rapture has happened, and if you're paying $15 a month, they will send out any emails or letters that you have already written to your pagan friends to let them know, hey, you better get right with Jesus. Again, this is for real. This is big business. I had a friend who used to have a bumper sticker on her car that says, in case of the rapture, this car will be unmanned, making that car a missile. Now, listen, I know people who believe this and disagree with me, and they have good hearts, and they love the Lord, and it's okay if you don't agree with me on this, but I'm going to talk about it because what you hope toward is what you live toward. Otherwise, why should Christians care about this world, what's going on around us, if God is just going to beam us up? Why should we live differently if God is just going to destroy our bodies in this world and all the life that we have isn't connected to the life that is to come? This, by the way, is why American churches are so bad at making disciples, because you can either be a legalist and make people terrified about God and like worried that if you don't get all the rules right, God's going to deep fry you, or you can be a grace-based person that says, you know what? You know, God, you're saved by grace, which is of course true, but it's not connected. It doesn't change who you are to fit into the world that is to come. Part of the problems of American Christianity is we're not making people look like Jesus, because why should we live differently now if the gospel is really about some other time and place? Okay, some of you who are Bible students may be thinking, well, doesn't the Bible talk about the earth being burned up? Which it does. It says the world will be destroyed like it was in the days of Noah. Do you know, by the way, you live in a world that was once destroyed? It was destroyed in the days of Noah. But it wasn't totally destroyed, or you wouldn't be living here. That's the language it uses. Like in 2 Peter verses chapter 3, it says, they deliberately forgot long ago by God's words the heaven came into being and the earth was formed out of water and by water. By these waters also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. By the same word, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and the destruction of the ungodly. Here's what Peter is saying, and we'll get into this more next week, because right after that, he goes in to God is going to create a new heavens and a new earth. The future of creation is not annihilation. It's purification. Now, I get it, because all of us have only known, we've only ever lived in a fallen world. It is understandable that we would think salvation means escape, but we would not think that if we had ever seen Eden, the Garden of Eden. Last week, we talked about the end of the Bible in Revelation 21 when heaven comes down. Look at what Jesus actually says. The one in Revelation 21:5, the one sitting on the throne said, "Look, I am making everything new." It is significant that God does not say he is making all new things. He is making instead all things new. Because no one can restore a masterpiece better than God. Do you know that's what God did in Jesus? When God raised Jesus from the dead, the resurrection of Jesus is the first fruits of what God is going to do for you, for what God is going to do for all of creation. This is why Paul, who is one of the first church planters, goes all over the world. He writes these letters back to these churches he plants, and he talks about resurrection a lot, about Jesus' resurrection. And one of those churches in Rome, he writes about, and he says, do you know everybody who gets baptized, you know you're surrendering your life, and you're also receiving a resurrection? That you're, when you get baptized, what God did for Jesus, he is going to do for you. And then Paul, in this same section, goes on in Romans 8 to say this. If you could go to Romans 8, verse 20 through 22. Against its will, all of creation was subjected to God's curse, but with eager hope, the creation looks forward to the day when it will join God's children in glorious freedom from death and decay. We know that all creation has been groaning, as in the pains of childbirth, right up to the present time. Groans of creation, the cancer, the pandemic, the divorces, the addiction, all of creation, the earthquakes, the tsunamis, all of creation is groaning. And what Paul is saying is, look, I know it's easy to get down, but the future of the universe walked out of that tomb on Easter morning. When Jesus returns, he will bring to all of creation what the resurrection brought to him. So where did the rapture come from, this idea that it was, God's future was going to be about someplace else, somewhere else? It came from another place in Paul's letters, where Paul is writing one of the first letters he writes to a church he planted in Thessalonica. It's a city in Greece. And there, people are dying. They're trying to figure out, what does the resurrection mean when these people that we love are dying and they're not being raised? And so Paul writes them in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. He says this in verse 13, "Brothers and sisters, we do not want you to be uninformed about those who sleep in death, so that you do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. For we believe that Jesus died and rose again, and so we believe that God will bring with Jesus those who have fallen asleep in him. According to the Lord's word, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet call of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. After that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will be with the Lord forever. Therefore, encourage one another with these words." Now, I think this is actually a very encouraging passage, but we have misused it in the past. We've used it in ways that go against what Paul seems to be saying in other letters he wrote. We acted like that passage is saying, just wait until God beams you up and gets you out of here. There was a children's song I heard growing up that goes like this. Somewhere in outer space, God has prepared a place for those who trust him and obey. Anybody heard that song? Yeah, okay, thanks. Who is writing our worship songs? Somewhere in outer space, is Spock writing our worship songs? Like, that's Gnosticism. It's this idea that the gospel has nothing to do with where we are now. the context of that passage that he's writing, and I hope this makes it come alive for you as it did me, but he's writing a church in Thessalonica. Now, this is a historical event that you can Google right after church if you want. But a couple of years before this letter was written, there was an earthquake that devastated the city of Thessalonica. I mean, just destroyed it. And it was so bad that they had to get federal money from Rome to be able to rebuild it. Now, a couple of years after they rebuilt the city, Caesar himself came to visit to see what they did with the money that he had given them. And when Caesar came, there was a word they used for that, parousia, which is the word he uses to refer to what Jesus is going to do. It's a rare word that is used in the New Testament, and it's a word that the people who were listening would have been like, oh, that's the Caesar returning word, because, by the way, Caesar isn't Lord, Jesus is. But what happened when Caesar came was all of Thessalonica went outside of the city to meet him. That was kind of the protocol. And then they took him back into the city to show what they had done with the resources he had given them. That's what the people who read this letter would have known that we did not. Here's what I want you to see. I think what Paul is saying is we will meet the Lord in the air while the earth is being renewed with cleansing fire. And then we will accompany our victorious King back to the new earth. Here's what I want you to see. Satan's destruction will be total. He will be exiled as a deposed dictator, and Jesus will take his rightful place as Lord of all. This is why Peter says we are looking forward to this. Okay, some of you Bible students may be thinking, well, what about what Jesus says about heaven? Look at this. In John chapter 14, before he dies, he circles up his 12 disciples, and Jesus says to them, do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms, and if that were not so, I would have told you that I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you may also be where I am. So it sounds like heaven is somewhere else. Yeah, it is right now. The New Testament scholarships point out that the word that Jesus actually uses there is the word mone. Let me hear you say mone. It means temporary dwelling, a stop on the road, like a Motel 6 that is looking for, and it's better than a Motel 6. It's looking forward to a further destination. Here's what Christians have believed for 2,000 years. The majority of Christians have believed this. Christians who die with God are with God now in heaven. They are our cloud of witnesses. They are watching us. They're participating in the worship this morning, even right now. They are cheering us on and interceding on our behalf. But there is a life after death. Those friends and family members, they're not just cheering us on. They're waiting for the resurrection of the body, their true and permanent body that's animated by the Spirit, their spiritual body. And like we talked about last week when Colby and Marley got married right here, in the end of the story, heaven and earth marry, that heaven comes down. Unlike every other ancient text, in the heavenly city of Jerusalem does not stay in heaven but comes down to earth. Unlike every other ancient religion, God brings heaven to earth, a renewed, restored creation. Heaven isn't the end of the world. It's the beginning of the world as it was always meant to be, a world without curse. Now listen, this may sound strange to some of you, but this really is what most Christians have believed throughout the centuries. And if you're a part of Churches of Christ, you need to know the people who started this movement, they believe this. David Lipscomb, Alexander Campbell, James Harding, all of them did. The majority of Christians have believed this throughout times, but we stopped talking about this as a movement because about 120 years ago, we started arguing about one little bitty part of this that I have no interest in arguing about. The thousand-year reign, which is a part of Revelation. It's kind of an obscure thing that it's easy to drill down into and make a lot out of. And we did. We had split after split after split. Some of y'all know of, you know, churches that started that were premillennial Church of Christ or postmillennial Church of Christ or what thing. And whatever it is. How many of y'all have heard of that? Okay, yeah. So there were so many arguments about that. And everyone used to believe in the stuff that we're talking about, but we stopped talking about because we didn't want to argue anymore. Isn't it just like Satan to take away God's greatest hope for us by making us argue over the details? I am not going to try to argue about anything on the thousand-year reign or how you interpret that. That's not what this is about at all. I'm not going to preach on that. I don't care what you do or do not believe on that, and here's why. About 10 years ago, when I was living in Texas, everywhere I went, I saw billboards that said, the world is going to end on May 21st, 2011. I know those were here, too. They were all over the country. It said, the billboard said, Noah knew the world was ending. You can, too. And it gave you a website. And if you went to the website and you added in the, you know, it said the math was hidden throughout all the Bible. And if you added in the right numbers and used the correct logarithm and just added a touch of crazy, you would come up with May 21st, 2011. I have a friend, Mike Steiner, who preached at Sandstone Church of Christ during that time. And at one point he went to Walmart and there was some people evangelizing. The world's going to end on May 21st. And Mike had 10 kids. So he went up to them and he's like, well, you haven't convinced me, but since you're so convinced, would you sign over the deed to your vans on May 22nd? Look, I know you're not going to need them anymore, right? But I still will have 10 kids and I sure could use them. And I thought that was genius, but they didn't bite on that. Now, the guy who made that prediction about May 21st, he has made that prediction a couple of other times, which, you know, at least he's persistent. But as the sun came up on May 22nd, I imagine there was a lot of like confused looks on people's faces as they, you know, looked at their leader like, hey, what happened? And I'm sure he dusted himself off and said something like, I forgot to carry the one or whatever it is. And then this whole thing eventually is going to start over with some other date. But there is a bigger problem to this. There's a time in the Gospels where Jesus is talking about the end of the world, and he says, actually, nobody knows the times or dates. Not even the Son. Not even the Son of God. Only the Father knows. Why would the Father not even share that with the Son? Why does God not give us ways to interpret, like, when what comes next is coming? Well, I think it's because God knows us. What if Jesus doesn't return on May 21st or whatever the next crazy date is? Because on May 22nd, there will still be lost people in Little Rock and kids without homes. Because on May 22nd, there will still be urban and rural poverty that leaves a large group of children in our state without the ability to eat on a regular basis. There will still be divorce. There will still be hurting, injustice, and suffering. And the church will still be called to do something about it. I think the reason God is so intentional about not telling us when and times and date is because he knows humanity's bent. He knows we will begin to try to live for then. Instead, what he calls us is to be a colony of heaven. Colony, which means we are trying to live out the life within our body of what comes next here and now. That means no matter what's going on in the world, when you are a part of this community of faith, things are different in here. That's why what we are hoping towards matters so much, because what you hope towards shapes how you live now. The Christian faith is, our hope is not a partial triumph. There is not going to be one single molecule of creation God is going to allow Satan to say, at least I got that. Our hope is not a partial triumph. Paradise lost will be paradise restored. And through Jesus, everything will be reconciled to God. And the new earth helps us realize how cosmic Jesus' victory is. We are going to have the home God always wanted us to have. Now, very quickly in closing, there are three things that this implies on our lives. One, the new heavens and the new earth informs and shapes who I want to be. Our hope should motivate holiness. By the way, this is why the Christian sexual ethic has been neglected over the past few decades in America and the West, because we've forgotten the importance of the body. Why should we live differently in our bodies than the rest of the world if our bodies are ultimately going to be discarded instead of resurrected and transformed? Here's what the Christian hope was saying a long time ago. God can tell you what to do with your body because you didn't make your body. You don't sustain your body. You're not going to resurrect your body. Your body is your way of telling Jesus is Lord to the world. What you do with your body is the way you bend your knee to God. And like we saw last week, the Christian sexual ethic of a man and a woman in a covenant relationship is a parable of heaven and earth becoming one. An inadequate view of heaven leads to an inadequate commitment to turn from sin. But what the Holy Spirit is trying to do in every one of our lives is make us into the kind of people who fit in now into the world that is to come. This is what 2 Peter says, "Dear friends, while you're waiting on these things to happen, make every effort to be found living a certain kind of way." The new heavens and the new earth helps me turn from sin and towards sinners. Rick Bowles was a 34-year-old surgical intern living in Boston when outside of his office he heard two loud booms a few years ago. The Boston Marathon was happening, and that was the day that the bombing went off at the finish line. And Rick Bowles grabbed his coat and ran towards the chaos. And later people asked him why he did that, and he said, "I was a 23-year-old man when 9/11 happened. And as I watched all that go down, I said, God forbid, if I ever find myself in a situation like that again, I wanted to be the kind of man that was running towards it, not away from it." We will talk about the realities of hell next week, but here's a preview of coming attractions. The hope of God's good future means light has shined in the darkness, and the darkness cannot overcome it. Jesus has built his kingdom, and he says the gate of hell cannot stop it. Notice, hell is on the defense. That's gates. That's defensive language. And Jesus is saying they're playing defense, and their defense stinks. And the third, final thing, the new heavens and the new earth compels me to pursue what ought to be. This is what I mean when I say what we hope for determines what we live for. We are called to witness this coming reality by confronting what is by what ought to be. Our confidence in the world that will be compels us to make a difference in the world that currently is. So about 15 years ago, I was having breakfast with a Jewish man. He grew up Jewish and he converted to Christianity a few years earlier. And I'd been studying all this, and I asked him, his name was Brother Rick. I said, "Brother Rick, tell me about what you grew up believing about heaven as a Jew." And he said, "Let me tell you a story," which is a very Jewish way of answering that. He said, "A few years ago, my mother was dying in Florida, and I went down to be with her in the hospital room. And for 3 days, she was catatonic. She did not talk or move at all. And then after a few days, she sits up and she looks past me and she says, 'Can you see it? It's so beautiful.' And then she lays down and dies." And I told that story at her funeral, and an older Jewish man came up to me and said, "Let me tell you about my story." He had been married to his wife for over 50 years when she contracted Alzheimer's. And he said, "It was incredibly painful watching this woman who I love so much slip away from me. She forgot her name. She forgot how we met. She forgot her kids' names. She forgot everything. First date, first kiss, everything. And eventually he had to put her into assisted living. And he would go and visit her every day. But she was just a shell of the woman she used to be. And then one day he went to visit her. And she remembered it all. How they met, first kiss, first date, kids, everything. And he said, 'I praise God because he was giving her back to me.' And then the next day, she died." And he said, "I realized God was not giving her back to me. God was giving her back to himself. And he just wanted me to see what that restoration was going to look like." The truth is, what we hope towards is what we live towards. But Christians for too long have forgotten how good what we hope really is. I am not making this stuff up. This is what's in the Bible. It is what the majority of Christians have believed for thousands of years. Every sad thing will come untrue. That's what Jesus' resurrection means. Heaven and earth were meant to be together, and one day they will fully and finally. And justice will roll like a river, and righteousness like a never-ending stream. Lions and lambs will lay down for get together. What mountains will clap for joy, because this is God's good world. And he hasn't given up on it.